This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Stacey Lynn in Washington. President Biden was welcomed to the presidential palace in Vietnam this morning. On the steps out front, about 100 children in red vests waved U.S. and Vietnamese flags. Service members in dress uniforms stood at attention as a military band played both anthems. Mr. Biden is there to work on strengthening the relationship between the two countries.
Today, we can trace a 50-year arc of progress in the relationship between our nations. From conflict to normalization to this new elevated status that will be a force for prosperity and security in one of the most consequential regions in the world.
Over 2,000 are dead and destruction is immense in Morocco after a massive earthquake hit Friday night. The BBC's Anna Hulligan in Marrakesh.
The search and rescue efforts are focused on the outskirts, those remote mountainous regions close to the epicenter, where it's hoped they can still reach some of the hundreds of people believed to still be trapped beneath the wreckage of their crumbled homes.
A manhunt in Chester County, Pennsylvania is on day 11 now. There have been several sightings of escaped convict Danilo Cavalcante, but he hasn't been captured yet. KYW's Jasmine Peyote.
He now looks a little differently. According to officials, he is clean shaven and was last seen wearing a yellow or green hooded sweatshirt, black baseball style hat, green prison pants, and white shoes. He is also now operating an unknown vehicle, possibly white in color, according to officials.
Cavalcante is a convicted killer. He escaped the prison by crab walking up two walls and pushing through barbed wire. Hurricane Lee is still a threat, but has weakened to a Category 2 storm. Lisa Bucci with the National Hurricane Center.
It's expected to slow down over the southwest Atlantic over the next couple of days. And then beginning about Wednesday, we're expecting it to make a turn towards the north and begin to accelerate.
There's a very challenging rescue operation underway in Turkey for an American who got stuck in a cave 3,000 feet down. Hungarian photographer Agnes Berentes.
We have to use vertical rope techniques and have to have a lot of narrow passage. This will be the hardest part of the rescue.
We now hear that Mark Dickey has arrived at a base camp about 2,300 feet below ground. He's being treated and is said to be in stable condition. They say he'll rest up before setting out again. Dickey's been trapped in the cave since August 31st. This is CBS News.
You need to hire fast and hire right? You need Indeed. Their all-in-one hiring platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates efficiently. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Your home for local news, weather, and sports across the airwaves and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Dow. Most older adults are not prepared to respond quickly in the event of natural disasters like wildfires or flash floods that can strike with little notice. Mike Mohn reports now on steps Wisconsin seniors can take.
Fewer than one in three adults age 50 and older have created an emergency plan for wildfires, flooding, tornadoes, summer heat domes, or winter bomb cyclones. The findings were issued by AARP and the University of Chicago. Tom Camber with AARP says the first step is to ensure having access to vital information.
Getting signed up for alerts, as we all saw with the recent fires in Hawaii, just a few minutes was the difference in life and death.
Camber recommends having a phone charger for your car, making sure emergency contacts are listed in your smartphone, and creating copies of important documents that you can access online. AARP offers a template for creating an emergency plan and links to resources, and Wisconsin Emergency Management has a list of preparedness tips for seniors on its website. Those in assisted living facilities and their family members should talk with administrators about their emergency and evacuation plans. Camber says it's critical to discuss your needs with a trusted support network before a disaster occurs.
But it also sets up questions around, for example, who's going to be your in-case-of-emergency contact in your phone? If you do have to relocate in an emergency, is there somebody who you've already identified where you can go and stay?
It's also important to have 3 days' supply of food and water and 3 weeks' supply of prescription medicines on hand and ready to go. Older adults are frequently more socially isolated, so Camber says it's especially important for neighbors to look out for each other during a crisis. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight. The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
It's never personal, only politics. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show with Dom and Crute. Weekdays from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning on this Saturday, September 9th, 2023. My name is Jim Santel, and yes, indeed, this is Morning Cannolis. This, as always, is our weekly review, our analysis, and our discussion with you of the most important news stories and events of the past week, sometimes even beyond the past week, focusing on law, government, and the aspiration for justice in America. We're here in this 9 o'clock hour and also in the 10 o'clock hour in the studios of Civic Media here in downtown Waukesha. I am joined in this studio by my ever faithful, highly professional, and focused producer. Her name is Anya, and together, we're going to be taking your phone calls and also your texts here through the Civic Media app. Processes to pursue our discussions this morning in all of these various areas. This morning, as always, we have an ambitious but achievable agenda. This, as always, a time for asking some three important questions. What happened during the course of the past week? What are these events that are animating our lives? What do we know about them? What are the facts? Why are they important? Why are they relevant? Why are they material, significant to the understanding of our lives and the livelihoods that we pursue here in America and right here in the state of Wisconsin? And finally, what do we do about those things? What kinds of actions should we take? What are responses, our answers? What kinds of things should we pursue in response to those things that we know, the important things in our lives? And that is the springboard for the first portion of our program this morning. As always, taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789 and also your texts, your communications with Anya and me through text. Go to Civic Media, identify your particular radio station, identify Morning Cannolis, and send us your messages, your comments, your questions there as well. All of that, our solicitation to you of this conversation this morning, this hour, and next hour, predicated upon the notion that through discussion and examination, understanding and development, academic and also perspectives on our lives, we can be better people in our state and in our nation. In the past 61 broadcasts, and yes, indeed, this is our 62nd broadcast on the services of Civic Media, in virtually all of those, we have had some wonderful callers, some folks who are calling in to provide information about relevant things in their lives, but also perspectives on the ways in which we together are citizens of this country and residents of this planet. Last week in particular, some tremendously helpful, thoughtful, and focused comments about the focus on what we do in America, that third question that we often ask here on Morning Cannolis. What are we supposed to do about those things? And there was one caller in particular. His name is Danny, and he was asking me in particular about what it is we do to ensure that we have candidates for office. We've got folks in appointed and elective office who are truly qualified for those positions. What kinds of things can we as Americans do to ensure that the people who are representing us in government, again, both appointed and elected, and in other civil service positions, the people who serve us on a day-to-day basis are qualified for those positions? And my response at the time was not only to invite invoke the Constitution of the United States of America with respect to the presidency of the United States of America, but also begin to talk about the other things that we can do as Americans and offer to Danny and to others listening at the end of our second hour last Saturday. Begin to talk about the ways in which we as citizens can engage in our communities to ensure that the people who are in fact representing us are those folks who truly do just that, committed to it, do that work through their intellectualism, their industry, their focus, their humanity, and their diplomacy. Again, their articulate ways of describing their missions, their views, their perspectives on the world. One of the ways which that can happen, of course, is to engage in the political process. Becoming involved in politics is an important aspect, if in fact you're inclined to do that. Showing up at meetings of elected representatives, sometimes even appointed representatives in our communities, asking them questions about the important things going on in our communities, becoming involved in political parties, again, if you are inclined to do that, by virtue of the things that they do to select candidates, and ensuring that as a part of that process, you've got folks who are truly among those people who should be truly representative of our nation, of our state, of our communities, asking them the specific questions about what qualifies them to serve in those positions. A lot of those political things are virtually critically important to the future of our nation. They're not necessarily in our Constitution, not necessarily in our statutes, but they're the predicates or the bases upon which we get those folks into office, and so incredibly important to become involved in that exploration of the ways in which people become elective officers and also are appointed to these various positions. That's one of the ways in which you can, of course, engage in that kind of activity. The other one, of course, is voting. Voting, an all-important issue which we talk about on a regular basis here on Morning Cannolis. And that leads into the first item on our very extensive syllabus this morning, having to do with voting. And something that happened just this past week in the area of voting rights and the Voting Rights Act in particular. We have chatted a lot in the past about a case called Allen versus Milligan. Allen versus Milligan, a Supreme Court case coming out of the United States Supreme Court just this past June, on June 8th, a decision by the United States Supreme Court under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act coming out of the state of Alabama. The predicates for that, the factual basis for that, again, this notion that representatives in the state legislatures should be drawing lines following every single census that's taken every 10 years that are truly representative to ensure that people who are elected to those offices, specifically congressional offices, but also state offices, to assembly and senate offices in the particular states, that those lines are drawn in ways that are truly ensuring that the franchise, the right to vote, is guaranteed to every single person in that state. And in Allen versus Milligan, the population, of course, in the state of Alabama, about 28% or so of the population in Alabama are people of color, black residents in particular, those folks who are responsible, of course, along with all members of the residents of the state of Alabama, for ensuring that they elect to offices, both federal and state, people who are truly representative of them. And what happened was that the state legislature, you may recall, in Alabama, made some decisions, did some line drawing, again, in connection with its obligatory responsibility to draw those lines back in 2021 and 2022. And they did so in a way that basically disenfranchised a significant portion of that 28% of the population, people of color in Alabama. The case went up to the United States Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, to a surprise to many of us, that under the Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act of the 1960s, that the state of Alabama, the legislature in particular, had indeed violated the law and was, by virtue of the line drawing that it had done, kept representatives from being elected to districts in Alabama that could, in fact, be majority black districts. In particular, the Supreme Court, majority of the Supreme Court, including Brett Kavanaugh and John Roberts, said that the Alabama legislature has got to go back and do that again, got to do it over, to ensure that that 28% and perhaps more people in the state of Alabama are truly represented by virtue of the ways in which the lines are drawn. The opportunities to elect from at least is what the Supreme Court said, two majority black districts that could indeed represent more directly and accurately the population of the state of Alabama. State of Alabama then back in July of this year went back and did that examination, reconsidered the line drawing that it had done a couple of years or so earlier, and surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, came back and said, we're not going to do what the United States Supreme Court has told us to do. They, instead of identifying two majority black districts that should indeed represent the population, the entire population of the state of Alabama, including people of color, the legislature in Alabama came back and said, no, we're only going to identify one of those. And they justified that. They justified that, or attempted to do so, on the basis that the lower court decision had some wiggle room, they said, in connection with the language that was the prescriptive aspect of this, telling them what to do. And this came back again to the three-judge panel in the Southern District of Alabama, looking over all of this, again, in the wake of the Supreme Court decision, telling the legislature to redo their maps. The legislature basically saying, we're not doing that. We're not doing what the Supreme Court has said. And that then prompts the review of the most recent non-decision, non-compliance by the legislature, by this three-judge panel in the Northern District of Alabama, the Southern Division of that district. And those judges are Judge Marcus, Circuit Court Judge Marcus, Judge Manasco, and Judge Moore. All of those last two are district court judges. This is a three-judge panel, again, under the civil rights laws and the Voting Rights Act in particular, reviewing what the legislature has done for a second, arguably a third time in this case. And what did this particular three-judge panel do just this past week? Just this past week, in one of the major decisions of our time, said the Supreme Court is indeed the Supreme Court. You need to follow what the Supreme Court has said. The court, in a 217-page opinion, went through all of the history in this case and described again the fact that the initial lawsuit here alleged that there was racial gerrymandering in violation of the Constitution and in particular in violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And in this omnibus 217-page order of just this past Tuesday, the three-judge panel coming out of the Northern District of Alabama, the Southern Division there, said that the decision by the legislature in Alabama could indeed not be supported by what the Supreme Court had said and what the three-judge panel had previously said. So that because federal law dictates that the Alabama legislature should have the first opportunity to draw a remedial map, we gave the legislature that opportunity. That opportunity has now come and gone, noting in particular in this order of just this past Tuesday, on July 21, the legislature enacted and Governor Ivey, the governor of Alabama, signed into law a new congressional map. But just like the 21 plan that had been the subject of the challenge to the Supreme Court, enjoined by this court, stopped by the court, the plan includes only one majority black district. And that's the basis upon which the three-judge panel once again said, you're not in compliance with the Supreme Court. When we come back after this first break, we're going to talk more about this all-important case coming out of this three-judge panel, coming out of Alabama, that describes once again what it means to vote in America, important for all of us. Stay with us for that discussion.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
And apparently, Maggie Dawn, big Newton lover of the Maggie Dawn Show.
I was so offended, Jane. You know how much I love and admire you. You're like my freaking radio hero. And then to hear you bash my Newton.
It's still bad.
You want the cakey part cakey. You want the jammy part jammy. And it's like bringing me back.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
We are back this morning on Morning Cannolis. It is Saturday, September 9th, 2023. Thank you once again for joining me this hour and hopefully next hour as well as we talk through a great variety of events, circumstances, news items coming out of government law and the aspiration for justice in America. Before the break, began our discussion this morning with this all-important decision of this past Tuesday, coming out of a three-judge panel in Alabama, finding for at least a second time that the Alabama legislature had indeed violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act by drawing lines with respect to the federal representation and also state representation in that state, basically disenfranchising at least 28% of the population, people of color in that state. The decision by this three-judge panel saying, number one, that you need to follow what the Supreme Court has said. The Supreme Court spoke about this in June, finding again that there had been a violation of the law, telling the legislature to do exactly what the law required. Legislature coming back and saying, we're not doing, Supreme Court, what you told us to do. Now this three-judge panel say, oh yes, indeed, you will do that. And we'll get to the remedy that the three-judge panel imposed in just a moment or so. Along the way, the three-judge panel says this to the legislature, putting its place, but also saying unequivocally that the record before us is complete. Before the three-judge panel, it includes evidentiary material submitted during the injunction proceedings that predated all of this, also expert reports, deposition transcripts, and other evidence submitted during this remedial or curative stage, if you will. We also have the benefit, the court says, of the parties' briefs, a hearing, three amicus briefs, that is, briefs submitted by parties to the court, parties who are not friends of the court, people who are not parties formally, but nonetheless who are involved in the issue in some way, and also a statement of interest by, yes, indeed, the Attorney General of the United States of America. His name, of course, Merrick Garland. The state, the panel's decision says, concedes that the 2023 plan, this most recent plan, does not include the additional district that is required by the Supreme Court. Indeed, the state has explained that its position is that notwithstanding our order and the Supreme Court's order as well, the legislature was not required to include that additional district in its 2023 plan. And here's where the language becomes all important. The court goes on to say this. This concession by the legislature that we're not doing what the Supreme Court told us to do controls this case. Court goes on to say this, because the 2023 plan does not include an additional district of the sort described by the Supreme Court and previously by this court, we conclude that the 2023 plan does not remedy the Section 2 violation that we found and the Supreme Court affirmed. We also conclude, under the controlling Supreme Court test, that the plaintiffs here are substantially likely to establish that this plan violates Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Under that act, the three-judge panel says, the statutory framework and binding precedent, the appropriate remedy is, as we already said, a congressional districting plan that includes either an additional majority black district or some additional district in which black voters have an opportunity to elect a representative truly of their choice. Goes on to say this: we discern no basis in federal law to accept a map the state admits falls short of this required remedy. And so what does the court do? What does this three-judge panel do? It's not going to send it back to the legislature. They've had two opportunities already to abide by the rule of law and have decided not to do that. The court says this: based on the evidence before us, including the testimony from the legislators, we have no reason to believe that allowing the legislature still another opportunity to draw yet another map will yield a map that includes an additional district of the sort described by the previous orders. Moreover, counsel for the state, that is the legislature, has informed the court that even if the court were to grant the legislature yet another opportunity to draw that map, it would be practically impossible for the legislature to do that in advance of the 2024 election cycle. In other words, time has now run up. And so the court says this: because we grant relief on statutory grounds and a fundamental and longstanding principle of judicial restraint requires that we avoid reaching constitutional questions in advance of deciding them, we are reserving the constitutional issues raised by various cases and positions and instead doing this. We have reached the conclusion, these conclusions in our order, that only that after conducting this exhaustive analysis of an extensive record under well-developed legal standards, as the Supreme Court instructs, we do not take lightly, the court goes on to say, federal intrusion into a process ordinarily reserved for the state legislature. But we have now said twice that the Voting Rights Act case, this one, is not close. And indeed, that's what the Supreme Court had said as well in its decision of back in June, finding that there had been a history, a very virulent history of discrimination in voting rights in Alabama. And then goes on to say this, which is a part of the media attention to this all-important decision of this earlier this week. The court goes on to say, we are deeply troubled that the state enacted a map that the state readily admits does not provide the remedy we said federal law requires. We are disturbed by the evidence that the state delayed remedial proceedings, but ultimately did not even nurture the ambition to provide the required remedy. And we are struck by the extraordinary circumstances we face. We are not aware, this three-judge panel goes on to say, of any other case in which a state legislature, faced with a federal court order declaring that its electoral plan unlawfully dilutes minority votes and requiring a plan that provides an additional district, responded with a plan that the state concedes does not provide that district. The law requires the creation of that additional district that affords black Alabamians, like everyone else, a fair and reasonable opportunity to elect candidates of their choice. The plan, advanced, articulated, voted on, and approved by the governor, plainly does not do so. That's strong language coming out of any court, including a three-judge panel convened to enforce the Voting Rights Act of the 1960s. We're going to talk more about the reason why this is so important for us here in Wisconsin, why it's so important for everyone in our nation to understand what's going on there in Alabama and what it says about the future of the enforcement of voting rights here in America and right here in the state of Wisconsin. Stay with us for that discussion right after this next break. I know that it's pretty up there. We can go hiking on Tuesday. With you, I'd walk anywhere. California has worn me quite thin. I just can't wait to see you again. Come Monday, it'll be all right. Come Monday, I'll be holding you tight.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
CBS News Brief. President Biden is in Vietnam working to strengthen relations and do more business with the country.
We're deepening our cooperation on critical and emerging technologies, particularly around building a more resilient semiconductor supply chain.
He's about to meet with the Vietnamese communist chief. Over 2,000 dead so far. Officials believe that number will increase from the devastating earthquake in Morocco. Still, people are trying to remain positive.
I'm keeping my fingers crossed that the number does not keep rising up.
Police in Pennsylvania still haven't been able to capture an escaped convict. But KYW's Jasmine Payot tells us he has been spotted.
Police say Friday's sightings were, quote, actual visual sightings, while Saturday's were caught on a Ring camera on East Pikeland Township. People we spoke with said they are surprised and worried that the search has lasted this long.
CBS News Brief. I'm Stacey Lynn.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
People won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, could potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
More than 80 million Americans depend on AM radio each month for news, weather, and emergency information. A new bill in Congress would make sure AM radio remains in cars. Because when cell and internet services are down, this free service could be your only lifeline. Text AM to 52886 and tell Congress to support the AM Radio for Every Vehicle Act.
Message and data rates may apply. You may receive up to 4 messages a month, and you may text STOP to STOP.
This message furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters.
If I could be you.
And you could be me.
For just 1 hour.
If you could find a way.
To get inside.
Each other's mind.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
We've all felt left out. And for some, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe, and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
93.5, The Tap.
We are back here on Morning Cannolis, Saturday, September 9th, 2023. Thank you for joining me in this discussion initially this morning of a major decision in the enforcement of the rule of law in support of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, this three-judge panel in Alabama telling the Alabama legislature that it cannot simply disregard the rulings, the directives of the Supreme Court, and making the decision in the end because they've had 2 opportunities already to do that and affirmatively chose not to follow the rule of law, that now this three-judge panel appointing what's called a special master and sort of a friend of the court in a different way, who's going to take on the responsibility for doing what the legislature has not done, namely to draw these lines in Alabama in a way that is consistent with federal law. The opinion by the three-judge panel says this: the special master and the cartographer, the map designer, the drawer, if you will, are directed to commence work forthwith on that remedial plan, and instructions on what they're supposed to do will follow this order. In other words, we're going to direct these people as the frontline workers on behalf of this three-judge panel to do what the legislature did not. We're going to ask them, we're going to direct them to put together lines which will then be imposed upon the legislature, the governor, and everyone in Alabama to ensure that voting rights are supported. Raises the issue then down the road once that is done, presumably fairly quickly. What happens then? Well, it's got the enforcement now, both at the Supreme Court and by this three-judge panel. One would hope that no one would pursue additional attempts to undermine what the Supreme Court has said, what the law says in the state of Alabama and nationwide, and that these would be the lines finally, that would be appropriately imposed upon the residents and the clerks and all the voters in the state of Alabama to ensure that that population of African-American voters, black voters in Alabama, gets the representation that it deserves under the law. As we well know, Alabama has had a history of noncompliance, of thwarting what the federal government has said in the past. Recall well that in the 1954 decision, Brown versus Board of Education, state of Alabama basically said, nope, we're not, in fact, going to segregate, we're not desegregate schools. We're going to continue segregating black and white schools, the public schools there in Alabama. George Wallace notoriously promising segregation forever. And it was only after the Supreme Court entered a second order called Brown versus Board of Education 2. And yes, indeed, there was some specific enforcement by the attorney general at the time, by the president, who directed that law enforcement authorities ensure that segregation is brought to an end in Alabama, that we moved toward that remedial end. There has been that history. We will see what happens here again in the area of enforcement of civil rights. That's why this is so important, not only to Alabama, not only to our nation, but also right here in the state of Wisconsin. We have got our own voting issues, both historically and presently. The rule of law this past week has prevailed, has told us unequivocally that it means something when courts direct you to engage in activities that ensure voting is complete for all your residents, all the people who are entitled to vote in the particular state. Voting is meaningful. It has power. It has impact. And that's what the decision this past week reaffirms for all of us. Significantly, going over to Florida, another decision, sending the same kinds of messages to all of us. This one coming out of a circuit court judge, a state judge named Lee Marsh. And he is finding that the governor-approved map that, again, did the same thing, a congressional map in Florida, likewise violates the state constitution, according to the judge Marsh, diminishing the ability of black voters in North Florida to elect representatives of their choice. And he there orders the legislature to draw a new one. So he's going back. He's saying, OK, legislature, I will give you a second opportunity to do the right thing. Again, a real affirmation of voting rights under the law and also there in Florida. The new map, which was drawn last year, basically had erased a congressional seat for a district where about 46% of voting age residents were black. Basically erased that off of the map entirely. And Al Lawson, who was a black Democrat, represented that district and promptly lost re-election in that newly drawn seat. Perhaps the best evidence of all of the invidious purpose behind doing this line drawing in the way that the legislature did. A circuit court judge there in Florida this past week saying, nope, can't do that. The Voting Rights Act requires more. The state constitution requires more. Do what you are supposed to do and ensure that voting is provided and opportunities to vote afforded to all members of our state. So two significant decisions in the area of voting rights. Important to understand not only the meaning of those as we talk generally about the rule of law in America. Other major issues of just this past week, a lot of this in the news. We're going to get to it in the remainder of this hour and also in the future. We had a major decision coming out of a federal district court in Washington, D.C., imposing a significant sentence on a fellow named Enrique Terrio, again, who is the head of the Proud Boys. We're going to talk about that, the meaning, the significance of that extraordinary 22-year sentence imposed upon him for seditious conspiracy engaging in January 6th. And in connection with January 6th, we're going to revisit right now the indictment coming out of Fulton County, Georgia, brought by Fonnie Willis, who is the DA there, against 19 different individuals for attempting to, not successfully, but attempting to undermine the vote there, to skew the Electoral College vote there, to somehow compromise what legitimate people did in voting and then getting those votes counted in the state of Georgia. We know well, based upon the indictment that we have chatted about in the past, a state court indictment, that 19 different people charged with various charges, including RICO, a racketeer-influenced and corrupt organization allegation against these 19 people, 41 counts altogether in that indictment, including influencing witnesses, election fraud, defrauding the state, computer tampering, falsifying documents, forgery, all kinds of things, again, that we have chatted about before. Among the 19 defendants is a fellow named Mark Meadows. We know that well. Mark Meadows, the former chief of staff of the White House under the Trump administration. And according to that indictment brought by the indicting grand jury in the state of Georgia not too long ago, Mark Meadows, among the people variously responsible for this RICO event, this RICO movement to try to stop the proper counting and the proper allocation, if you will, even of voting rights in Georgia that undermined or attempted to undermine the result there. We know in particular that Mark Meadows, as a part of his testimony recently in a federal court there, had testified that Donald Trump directed him to set up that now famous phone call on January 2nd of 2021 between Donald Trump and Brad Raffensperger, who was the Georgia Secretary of State at the time. You may recall, well, that was the call in which the former president said, you know, I need about 12,000 more votes, just enough votes to ensure that I get the electoral votes coming out of the state of Georgia. Meadows testified during the course of a recent hearing in federal court that that was one of the things that he did at the request of the former president. He also testified that he had visited a place called Cobb County, Georgia, where a ballot audit was then taking place. And he went down there, apparently, again, at the encouragement of the former president to try to determine whether or not some election fraud claims were supported. And he indicated during the course of his testimony that he wasn't permitted to go in, wasn't permitted to do that, but plainly reached out to some authorities there to try to, in some way, influence that process as well. And there's more in the indictment against him. Why is this all significant? Well, this past week, again, a major decision, again, enforcing the rule of law, this time again in Georgia, with respect to where that particular indictment as to Mark Meadows is going to be tried. Mark Meadows, in a series of motions filed through his attorneys prior to the hearing of a couple of weeks or so ago, recent days, and specifically before a major decision issued by a federal district court judge just this past week, this major decision on the Mark Meadows petition. What was that petition all about? It was to try to get the state prosecution moved from Fulton County, again, the state venue there, into federal court. And the premise for that decision, that movement, if you will, that decision to petition the court to do that, was that these things that Mark Meadows did at the behest of the former president of the United States of America were things done, wait for it, in the context of his duties and responsibilities as the chief of staff of the White House at the time, things that are required of him by virtue of his appointment to this important spot. Now, we know it very well based upon our previous discussions that there is, in fact, a statute, Section 1442. We've talked about a lot that says, you know what, if you are a federal official and you are charged in state court by individuals who led to civil rights violations, other violations of the law, and it is clear that the activities, the events, the circumstances that prompted that state court lawsuit are premised upon things that you did in the course of your duties and your responsibilities as a federal employee, appointed, elected, and otherwise involved in this service to America, if those kinds of things are indeed a part of the assignments given to you in that official capacity, there's a process for removing that, changing the venue, moving it from state court to federal court, and getting the federal court to oversee the prosecution, the litigation of the particular claims against you. There are also things in the Federal Tort Claims Act, other things that require substitution that go beyond what this particular case invokes. But the notion is that there is that process. The premise of it, once again, is you've got to be able to establish that your petition, your motion to the federal judge to get that case removed is based upon the notion that what you did, whatever it was that you allegedly engaged in, that was done by virtue of the assignment given to you by the people, whether through the elected process, the appointed process, to do something in your duties and responsibilities, color of law. And here, let me offer this perspective, which I advanced last week as well, that the position taken by Mark Meadows in petitioning the court for this removal is absolutely absurd. There is no there. This is not a close question at all. And then the federal district court judge appropriately listened to all this testimony, accepted the motion as he is required to do, listened to the testimony, gave some consideration to it, and yes, this past week found unequivocally, as Judge Jones, Stephen Jones of the Northern District of Georgia found, he said there's no federal jurisdiction over this criminal case. The outcome of this case will be for a Fulton County, a state court judge, and trier of fact to ultimately decide. He rejected out of hand, in a very lengthy opinion, going through all the statements, all the positions articulated, advanced by Mark Meadows in oral statements and then in written presentations to him, rejected all of them, finding once again that the activities in which he engaged were certainly not those kinds of things you would contemplate would be assigned to a federal employee in the course of their regular duties and responsibilities. Specifically, Judge Jones found that much of this was campaign-related in nature, political in nature, not a part of your normal assignments as a federal officer. Also indicated more than around the edges that the allegations in any event are not only that these are campaign events, but they may have been illegal. And certainly under the statute, under federal law, the notion that you somehow get to remove allegations of criminal activity not done in the course of your duties and responsibilities from a state court to a federal court, that would be your position is absurd. And one of the reasons why this is important, number one, is not only for the conclusion which Judge Jones comes to in this expansive decision, excellent to read, understandable, accessible, not only around the edges, but right in the middle of its core meanings and import, significant not only to ensure that this case remains where it should, which is prosecution of state offenses in state court, but also does a couple other things. Number one is it sends messages to others among the 19 also charged by Fani Willis that unlikely their cases will receive this reception by a federal district court judge. Mark Meadows arguably had the best case of all, and it wasn't very strong at all. When we come back after this break, I'm going to talk more about why this is significant, Mark Meadows, other defendants, and more broadly, the focus on all of us on understanding what's really going on in Georgia in this connection, and also another major news story coming out of Fulton County just this past week. Stay with us for that all-important discussion.
Hey y'all, this is Ronte, and a little thing I love about the Chick-fil-A honey pepper pimento chicken sandwich is the pimento cheese. I was like, go cheese, go pimento, go honey, go get it.
Hi, this is Chantrese, and a little thing I love about the Chick-fil-A honey pepper pimento chicken sandwich is the mild spiciness of the pickled jalapenos. No, it's the crispy chicken. Actually, I can't decide. It's the entire sandwich.
Order the honey pepper pimento chicken sandwich on the Chick-fil-A app today, available for a limited time. Real Chick-fil-A guests paid for their testimonials.
Help US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org, brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
93.5, The Tap.
Don't let biased algorithms or degree screens or exclusive professional networks or stereotypes. Don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
Civic Media Radio Stations, providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
93.5, The Tap.
And we are back in this last segment of our first hour here on Morning Cannolis, talking now about the latest developments just this past week coming out of Fulton County, Georgia, in particular. This important decision, a procedural decision, affirming what needed to happen under the rule of law, finding that indeed the motion of the former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, to move his case from state court into federal court should be denied. The point about this is there was no significant question here. This is not a close question. The judge did what he needed to do, entertained the arguments, both oral and written, and made the conclusion, came to the conclusion, that indeed Mark Meadows' petition was unfounded, no basis upon which to do this at all, sending the message not only to him that he will remain in state court, but there are others who likewise want to follow that road as well. They have less compelling cases than even Mark Meadows did. Unlikely, highly unlikely, we'll go out on a limb here and even predict, impossible to believe that anybody is going to be successful in petitioning this federal district court or another court to get that case removed from state court into federal court. And that underscores a larger issue here, which is an awful lot of this is in the category of absurd. This is stuff that's sort of beyond the pale when it comes to arguments that are legitimate, which the federal district courts, the state courts should entertain on a regular basis. This is not one of them. And I think it's important for all of us to appreciate that. We see more and more in some of the litigation going on, this notion that all of these absurd principles and these arguments indeed should get a full exposure and a full exposition in the courts. But nonetheless, they're premised upon absolutely positively baseless theories. We saw this past year or so when the Supreme Court entertained the notion that state courts have no involvement in deciding voting disputes, that involving a case called Moore versus Harper. You remember this well. We talked about this a lot. The independent state legislature theory. Again, a crazy theory, a theory that is not at all supported by the Constitution, by any legal principles, and yet it's advanced and it receives its day in court, as it should, given what our courts are required to do. But the long-lasting, the residual concern that I and others have about this is it tends to send this message that all of these unsupported, completely ridiculous theories have some weight to them. And this is just a matter of judges weighing and sifting to determine whether or not, indeed, these particular positions should be advanced. Here, you're not even close. You're not even close. And America needs to understand that this is not one of those petitions. When it comes to things like guilt and innocence, absolutely. That's the ultimate decision that a jury will make as to all 19. Decisions about what evidence comes in and what doesn't come in, all of that incredibly important. And those are material, and there can be reasonable people arguing about reasonable positions on those. And reasonable people can even disagree. That's why we have judges in the end to make those determinations. But more and more in America, in our courts, we've got these advocates. We've got lawyers. Yes, indeed. We've got parties, including the former president, including others, articulating positions in our federal and state courts that have no basis in law and in fact at all. And it's important to label them as such. And when we engage in discussions as we do here on this broadcast and in private and in personal discussions, individual discussions, group discussions, important to identify those things about which reasonable people can disagree and which there can be disputes and those that are not. This, once again, this past week, not a close question. A reason to appreciate and embrace the rule of law, not necessarily a reason to celebrate anything here, because it simply confirms that, yes, indeed, the sun rises in the east, as indeed it continues to do. Mark Meadows told this past week this his petition is without any merit, and he remains in state court, as do others. A significant other issue coming out again out of Fulton County just this past week, and that is this release by the court there of the transcript, the records, the report of the investigative grand jury that was doing all this work last year and times before that to determine what happened in Georgia. You may recall well that this investigative grand jury was looking at great numbers of witnesses. 75 witnesses altogether came before the grand jury there in Fulton County, describing various things that happened, much of which, not all of which, but much of which made its way into the indictment issued ultimately by an indicting grand jury, a second grand jury in Fulton County. And that's the predicate, that's the document that we now see in the state court there that Fani Willis is prosecuting. But just this past week, this final report of the investigative grand jury was unsealed by a judge in Friday, just yesterday. And the panel, interestingly, as a result of the disclosure of this information, this report coming out of this investigative grand jury's work, found that there were a number of people, almost 20 or so, that were not indicted by the investigative grand jury, who were recommended for indictment by the investigative grand jury, not indicted by the indicting grand jury. And among those people, Senator Lindsey Graham, for his entreaties, his engagement with some folks in Georgia, and also former Senators David Perdue, Kelly Loeffler, others in Georgia, Michael Flynn, the former National Security Advisor, all of these folks, again, described in this report for their involvement in matters related to trying to undermine the vote as it was taking place in Georgia. Now, why is this significant? Why is this also a rule of law issue to understand in our continuing work on civics here on Morning Cannolis? Well, it's important because it not only describes what the process there in Georgia is, that is, its investigative grand jury, during this very expansive focus on all these things that happened, including the involvement of something in excess of 40 people altogether involved in this attempt to undermine the election, the voting there in Georgia. Important to understand that process and the way that the Georgia law works, because, again, we're all now in this national focus on the civics of our nation, including the state of Georgia. But also important to note what the grand jury there did. The indicting grand jury accepts and reviews and takes this investigative report from the investigative grand jury and chooses in its discretion not to indict everyone who's recommended. Now, what are the reasons for that? What could be going on here? A number of different things also to be understood as we try to make sense of what's going on in Georgia. We know that 19 of those 40 people were indeed indicted. That includes the former president and many other people, Mark Meadows among them. But we also know that many people, including some of the false electors, others involved, these former federal senators, Senator Lindsey Graham, Michael Flynn, some of the other Trump-aligned lawyers, Cleta Mitchell, Lynn Wood, all those folks also not indicted. probably by virtue of exercises of discretion by the prosecutor, Fannie Willis, there. She has a great responsibility, not only in terms of organizing the investigation, presenting it to an investigative and then indicting grand jury, but also making discretionary decisions in her role as the prosecutor. And we come back in our second hour here on Morning Cannolis. We're going to talk more about the role of a prosecutor, because this story this past week raises that issue, identifies yet another thing to understand about civics in America, the role of the grand juries, the role of prosecutors, and the discretion necessarily exercised by prosecutors to ensure that the rule of law is advanced. Stay with us for that second hour coming up right after this break.
It's my own downfall.
The RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight.
The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know what's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. You are listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.